I've been working on a catchy title for a while, so the title is more trying to capture ideas, kind of capture vision, and that's part of why I'm here, is to try to sort of articulate a clinical perspective and give you sort of a vision of how I think from the clinician side of things, we can really make some progress with data flow and information exchange to improve not only care of individual patients. Can you guys hear me, by the way? Okay. Care, how we can engage those clinicians in such a way that they'll not only take better care of their own patients, but they'll start to give us even better information to support public health missions. As Roland mentioned, I have a clinical training, and about 8 years ago when I got out of that training, I went and did a medical informatics master's. It wasn't enough to do those two things, but at that time, I had visions and ideas about a new paradigm for how data could get brought to the front lines of care. Part of that brought on by moonlighting experiences and sort of plopping down into a place in a city where you're all of a sudden have somebody who's sick and has an infection in front of them, and you got to figure out what to do. An overwhelming amount of evidence in both internal medicine and pediatric sides that you feel obligated to keep on top of, but it's impossible to keep on top of without information tools to support it. So some of this is an evolution of that work. The Olympics and the experience with RODS definitely gave me that opportunity, because when I entered informatics training, it wasn't quite clear. I had this vision, these ideas, but it wasn't quite clear that the data flowed, that the data was there, and that the tools were there to roll it up and get it out to people, and it was a little humbling. And then along came the Olympics and bioterrorism, and boom, all of a sudden people are really excited about pulling these things together, and that really shifted and made things possible. So, much like Deborah had to show, this is not just my work. This is the work of our center group. It's a collaboration between a very large integrated healthcare delivery system I'll tell you a little bit more about later in the talk, the University of Utah, academic centers, Matt Seymour, who's the PI on our center grant, and some other PIs, a host of people that have skills ranging from health services research to you name it, and then a tight collaboration with our health department as well, and I've left a lot of names off here. Okay, so the driving rationale behind this is, and I'm going to introduce the concept of population-based clinical practice. And these are more of a thesis. It's more of something to throw out there. It's something that needs to be tested, needs to be evaluated, but that improving population-based practice amongst clinicians, I think, is an important goal. Population-based practice, I'm also going to argue, requires population-based data, and that I think the development and evaluation of tools that accomplish this kind of information exchange need to be a priority for research and development, and less Leonard has articulated that nicely. I'm going to walk through what population-based clinical practice is. I'm going to do that with a scenario. I'm going to show you a system that's evolved and what we're working on to get data to frontline clinicians in Utah. I'm going to present a research model that we're using to methodologically evaluate how that information can be pulled together and used. And then I'm going to finish with some highlights of a survey we completed that I'll be presenting in detail this fall. And I'll try to move pretty quickly through it. So since you're not a lot of clinicians in the room, the clinical scenario is, I want you to imagine for a second, you're a doctor working in an emergency room or an urgent care after hours kind of setting, late spring. You have a mom who brings in her two-year-old son, Timmy, who has acute onset of fever and diarrhea. You're going to have about 5 minutes to see this kid and come up and make your decisions about what you want to do with him. And mom's going to have lots of questions. What does Timmy have? Is anything going around? What can we do about it? What's going to happen to Timmy? Is there a risk to my other children? And you're going to have to try to, either dodge all those questions or come up with answers and try to look like you don't have uncertainty, which is inherent in medical decision making. You're always making decisions in the face of uncertainty, and you can't let people realize that you have that much uncertainty. So what infects Timmy clearly matters. It allows you to avoid harm to him. It allows you to maximize benefit to not only him, but to public, so that you're not missing opportunities to detect intrusions into the public's health. Is it a bacteria? Is it a virus? Is it parasitic? All of these have different interventions, potentially, and they all have potentially different implications for public health, the stuff that you routinely expect to see and the stuff that, when it pops up, you need to let public health know about. Helps you forecast natural history, helps you educate, helps you predict and forecast for parents what to watch for, how to monitor their child, and what they can do to assure a good outcome. So imagine you've got a Dr. A who practices without much of a social context, kind of like me straight out of residency. I didn't know the city I was working in. I had little clue about what was circulating in that town at any given time. So what I had available was, what are they telling me? What are their signs? What are their symptoms? I might have, if I had the time and remembered, to ask the right questions about, who you've been exposed to that's sick? Where have you traveled? Do you have pets? Are you swimming in the community swimming pool? And then I can do an exam, and I can order some tests if I know which tests are available and how well well they perform, I can do that. And then there's knowledge. You fall back on what did I learn in training, what did I learn last week, what have I seen in the last couple weeks that'll help me answer that question better. And then Dr. B, who I want all of our doctors to be like, has a more of a population-based clinical practice approach. He has knowledge of local incidents of various infectious diseases that he's able to work into this framework of how he makes medical decisions. So knowledge that clinicians have for making medical decisions can come from, and this is putting all their biases aside, and that's a whole talk in itself, what affects physician biases in decision making, but they may have knowledge about regional disease activity. You could articulate that as a community perspective, what's happening in their community. They have knowledge about clinical presentations, natural history, how various infections may present that are slightly different than others, and questions that can help them distinguish amongst those. You could refer to that as a clinical epidemiology perspective. They have knowledge, hopefully, about evidence supporting the use of diagnostic tests and treatment options. That's the DX and RX. And they have, and we call that evidence-based practice. And then there's knowledge about expected clinical outcomes, what's likely to happen based on the natural history of the disease or based on what they're doing to a specific patient. We call that an emphasis on outcomes. And they may have knowledge about efficacy and availability of preventative measures to alter the course of that illness. And that would be called an emphasis on prevention. And Ibrahim and Savitz et al. Have come up with a nice framework for this. They're calling these principles of population-based clinical practice. That's the reference down there. And I think it's a nice nice way to roll these all up. And that's kind of part of our framework. Okay, so we're to illustrate where docs in Utah are getting information and how this can work, I'm going to go through an example of respiratory pathogens. The example I was talking about before with Timmy, by the way, was a cryptosporidium outbreak, and I was going to tease you a little bit, and they should have asked, was he swimming in the community pool, if he just knew a little bit of information from public health that, yeah, we've seen a couple cases of crypto, you should be asking questions about are you swimming in a community swimming pool, and you should test using test X. But for respiratory pathogens, a doc might get stuff from the news media. This is not a joke. This is actually put out by our local Channel 4. It's called What's Going Around, and I chuckle every time I see it on the news. But they'll call up six or seven doctors and say, you know, what are you seeing? Sinus infections, diarrhea, strep throat. Not very specific, not much information content, but maybe it's useful. I don't know how helpful that is to parents or to doctors. They may, again, have had a lot of experience recently, been training. They get word of mouth, either from their own family, from colleagues, from patients showing up and telling them, well, there's a sign at daycare saying that such and such was going around, and that's how they learn that something's happening in their community. They may get bulletins from public health and authorities, and those are often limited to reportable diseases. And then, of course, there's the internet, which, you know, Deborah demonstrated there's lots of sources out there, and doctors are going lots and lots of places to try to find information. Here's a pretty prototypic example of influenza surveillance data, for example, that comes out of Utah that has influenza-associated hospitalizations, sentinel surveillance, the routine kind of stuff. And then there's CDC sources, like the National Respiratory and Enteric Virus Surveillance System, which I can, you know, drill in after probably 10 clicks to find information that's specific to Utah. But I'm going to argue that the best place for them to get information is giving them population-based data from their own region. So that data can come, population-level data can come from a lot of different sources. Microbiologic testing, healthcare utilization, syndromic surveillance, influenza-like illness, notifiable diseases, absenteeism. And, you know, we're all working on all of these for public health surveillance. But the micro testing, I think, in my experience, has really been what's most valuable to a practicing clinician to tell me, and this was part of my frustration with the early on in the rod system, is yes, I can watch a respiratory season play out, but I don't know what all is going into that. There's a lot of things that go into respiratory, so how does that help me make decisions when I've got a patient sitting right in front of me? You can roll that data up into information, then you can distribute that, and you'll see a little bit more of this figure later on. So just a quick very important side point. The laboratory that I'm working in is Intermountain Healthcare. If you're not familiar with it, it's located in the Intermountain West. It's a very large, vertically integrated, not-for-profit healthcare system. Big market share, where in some of the areas where our population is really dense, they have probably 60, potentially 70% of the population covered and deliver that much care. 21 hospitals, urban-rural settings. They got a bunch of urgent cares, which I actually work in as well. And they have a whole bunch of other clinics as well. Very robust, long history of health information technology, sorry for the jargon, a very solid electronic medical record, a lot of expertise in data warehousing with data flowing from all those hospitals, all those clinics into a central data repository, and then an enterprise data warehouse that runs in parallel to that has all that information in it as well. A legendary and well-known track record for quality improvement and a focus on using data to drive care processes. So an ideal place for me to play and do research, big web presence, and they do a ton of viral testing, and that's what makes some of these visualizations you're going to see here in a second possible, to the tune of probably 40 to 50,000 viral tests run just in last year's season. So now you've got coverage 60% of a state with a lot of testing going on in a routine clinical practice because they have economies of scale and can offer it really cheap, and they have a culture that of clinicians that find it really valuable. So why are pathogen-specific population-based data so useful to me and to other clinicians? Well, I think this graph illustrates it nicely. This is a percent of visits for respiratory complaints to our urgent cares graphed against this secondary y-axis. And you can see here's our yearly respiratory season. And here's a spike that shows up, every time all the primary care clinics close and everybody gets shunted into emergency departments and urgent cares. And there's all these shoulders and all these other spikes in here that I don't know what that is. But if you throw in a little adenovirus, which happens to be around all the time and has a lot of different clinical manifestations, I get a little information, not much, but you throw in parainfluenza, all of a sudden I'm starting to be able to explain some of the shoulders on this respiratory season. Throw in influenza, all of a sudden I've got a nice explanation for that big spike. And you throw in RSV, a favorite for attacking children, and you've got a pretty, well, at least more complete picture emerging that is useful for me to know what's circulating. So you got a big massive respiratory season composed of a bunch of different epidemics. I think that speaks for itself. So the system that we've developed has evolved over time. We have a catchy name now called GermWatch. It evolved from a local, Excel database in 2000 in our primary children's micro lab to when I got involved in 2004 type time frame, we started using the enterprise data warehouse to generate our reports. It has feeders from all the major hospitals that have hospital-based laboratories and micro facilities, and they go into the laboratory information system. We do daily extraction, cleaning up a whole bunch of dirty stuff in the data. That's a whole other talk in itself, but to get rid of duplicates and proficiency testing, all this kind of stuff. And then we have optimized tables that allow us to serve up reports. These reports now get emailed out weekly along with a brief summary, bulleted summary of what type of activity we're seeing in the region to well over 200 clinicians. And we have customized charting tools. You'll see a couple more pictures of this in just a second. So you could actually go in, and our public health people can go in and select and look at various things. I'll show some of those in a second. And been playing around with some map representations of this data as well. And coming soon, we're going to be able to run some analytical tools and packages against this data as well that should be useful. Just some screenshots from the system. You land on it here with links to a whole bunch of pathogen respiratory virus, enterovirus, rotavirus. We've recently brought on Cryptosporidium and some other gastrointestinal pathogens here. An update that's located here in the middle, and then linking out to our partner health department sources as well. If you go to the respiratory virus surveillance page, you can get some more information. Some of your tools actually be really nice to plunk in here as Deborah. But you do graphing, you can look at maps. Those graphs can show you RSV is green here, influenza A is blue, purple influenza B is blue. And you can, you know, customize these. You can select age ranges, you can do different regions, and you can interact with a lot of these. The clinicians don't interact a ton with these, but I do, and our public health people do. And you can actually start to play around with what's going to be the most compelling graph to show this week, for example. I think this graph illustrates nicely why this is helpful. I mentioned, you know, parainfluenza, common virus, often comes late fall or early spring. And if you just look at all parainfluenza, you just get this sort of bimodal activity. But this is actually parainfluenza 1, and this is parainfluenza 3. So we subtype them, and those two can present very differently and have different outcomes. And I can, you know, give people specific information. Oh, that's going to be more like croup. That one's going to be more like a lower respiratory tract bronchiolitis. And it helps me distinguish and do different things. How am I doing on time, Roland? Okay, here's a map. I'm started to play around with these using the Google API. How useful these are, we need to test. Don't know, but it's fun. Looks good. It's fun to show a slide of. Just another example of how compelling this data is. This is our rotavirus last four seasons, and you guys probably have seen some of this being public health types. The rotavirus vaccine really came out last year, and this was our delayed and minimal rotavirus season. You know, right there, it took me 10 seconds to generate that graph. And that was recently published in the MMWR. So all of a sudden I can show docs, hey, look, when you vaccinate, look what happens to this virus. It goes away. Isn't that nice? This is our Cryptosporidium outbreak from last year. I'll have to confess, we did not have this up when it happened. Boy, but if we would have, we would have picked it up probably a lot sooner. It got missed by our RODS implementation in Utah. But now I got it. So if I see some cases this year, we'll be right on top of that epidemic as well. So this is a big slide. I don't have time to go through it all, but just to sort of show you, we're trying to root our work in pretty robust academic methodology. This is our research model. You've seen this panel talking about data, rolling up to information, rolling up to distribution methods. This is a utilization model, a fairly well-vetted unified theory for acceptance and use of information technology, trying to predict whether people are going to use them. And all these are moderators, basically. How well does it improve their performance? Is it hard to get to for effort? Is there social influences? Are parents expecting me to use it? Do my colleagues expect me to use it? Is it easy to get to? Are the conditions right to help me use this technology? So that's our a model we use to develop a survey. Down here, I won't spend much time, but we're mapping out outcomes, what we want to improve. This is sort of the process of an acute care visit that involves intake and questions that get asked, potentially point of care testing that gets done before a doctor even sees a patient, and then stuff that would happen in an evaluation management sort of phase of examination, testing, and the likes, and then what kind of information, education, and whatnot that people would get at the end of that visit. So using that model, we've done a survey that I'll just show some highlights of. I'm presenting this in more detail at Fall AMIA this year. But why do clinicians find this useful? We wanted to actually start to quantify it a little bit. And when we asked them if it improved their diagnostic accuracy, they say, yeah, well over 90%. And this is a survey of about 100 urgent care providers in the IHC system, and we had about a 60% response rate. So it's pretty good, because these are my friends and colleagues. They answered my survey for me, so that was nice. So does it help with communication? Yep, they can describe what's going around. It helps describe their treatment decisions, why they're not using antibiotics, why they would order a test, for example. Does it help generally with medical decision making? You know, still a fair amount of agreement here that they think, yeah, it'll help me decide if I want to do a viral test, which test to order, do I want to test for pertussis? And I think very critically, will they prescribe antibiotics and antivirals? Interesting here, I've thought all along that this could improve productivity and efficiency. If you know how to, you know, present a pitch to a parent that they've got a viral illness and you got all this supporting, you know, a graph and some information, but not everybody gets that just yet, so we're kind of lukewarm on whether it helps them with productivity and efficiency. And it may or may not actually improve that. It needs to be studied. So general utilization and impressions, our docs in Utah anywhere accessing multiple local and national sources. The CDC will be happy to know that they go there most often, but they don't go there as frequently as they go and access our stuff out of GermWatch and stuff from the local health department. They think that most of them get it. They understand how this can be applied in their practice. It's not a complex thing to understand how knowing this would be useful. They think it reflects what they see in their practice, but on the flip side, they don't say that their practice and their clinical experience is enough to really keep them informed about what's going around. And I love that the patients, they tell us that their patients and their colleagues expect them to know this data, because social pressure is always helpful, right, for affecting change. and an opportunity that some of them think it requires effort and time. So it gets to how do we integrate it in workflow? How do we make it more accessible? So is that okay? Okay, so our lessons learned, these are more sort of anecdotal, but I hear them again and again, that providers want population data. They want it to be clinically relevant. They want it to be locally applicable. They want it to be generated by a trusted source and be readily accessible. They want it synopsis. They want it to be easily interpreted because they don't have a lot of time or don't spend a lot of time looking at these kind of things. We've got to make it really easy for them to consume. In line with that kind of idea is that they tend to prefer things being sort of pushed to them, but you got to be careful with how much stuff you push and how much you put there. And they ultimately want it to be integrated with their clinical workflow. They don't quite understand how that can work or how that would look, but that's where we can help. And along the way, I've had people asking for lots of other stuff, and it opens up this can of things that they're interested in. They want it, you know, a surveillance graph on the top of a virus handout. They want information, you know, detailed about how things present clinically and what the outcomes are. They want information about the testing. Is it available? And does insurance cover it? What's the cost to the patient? Do they want their own regional antibiotic resistance pattern so that they, when they do decide to make an antibiotic decision, that they know exactly what they should be prescribing. And some of them are very progressive. They want to know how they're prescribing relative to their colleagues. So, and that's been shown to be helpful in reducing unnecessary antibiotic utilization. And in short, they really want to do better. And it's a big opportunity because we can help. We can, pooling together our resources of public health and clinicians, we can come up with better tools that support these doctors and make them have an intellectually rewarding environment and do better taking care of patients. Quick comments about success factors. You know, it's hard to generalize everything that we do in Utah to the rest of the state, but collaboration is key, to the rest of the country, but collaboration is key. Public health, academia, and healthcare, very supportive, progressive healthcare system has helped, and their data systems and their approach to clinical care generally. Sustained clinical testing is maybe hard to reproduce in other areas, and a lot of domain expertise, the data warehousing, how to generate reports, how to do analysis, how to process the clinical microbiology results and make sense of what can be a mess sometimes, and then an active e-business group that helps us and is excited about generating these tools because they're carrots for getting doctors to look at other stuff. Oh, hey, there's some other things on this web page I want to look at too. And then clinical champions, people that are leading the charge and making this stuff happen. So future directions, optimal data visualizations, what's out there, what's going to work, how do we roll it up, can we do it as metaphors, information dashboards, how do we get it in a form where it's easy to consume, what are the optimal ways to get it out there, is it info buttons, is it RSS feeds that get plugged into the medical record widgets, I'm really captivated by, integration. Not just for the name, they actually are really cool. Integration with clinical workflow is a huge goal for us. Where can you put this in, right in the medical record that they're using? And then one of the harder things is how do you develop metrics for population-based clinical practice? Because we need to be able to study the impact of rolling these tools out. And so this is an active area for us to try to figure out how we're going to, you know, measure change that could be affected by these tools. So I just threw together a widget example, iGoogle population style. So here's my viral testing panel telling me what's happening locally. I can scroll along here and get counts. Coming up with maybe an influenza or parainfluenza meter. I can just put the CDC's influenza feed right on there, a couple other things. And so there's a lot of promising technologies out there. And I will stop and take questions.
I think we have time for one question.
Yes, sure.
The question is, first of all, thank you for a very good presentation. The question will be, with regards to the population, whatever is going on, outbreaks, local outbreaks in the real time, is they provide position, is it going to add another bias and contribute to the missed diagnosis of the patient? For example, if you have a norovirus outbreak and then you get a child with whatever respiratory
condition, right. It's a great question, and it's only a small portion, and I'll try to rephrase it. Does providing data saying, oh, here's all these viral things, here's all this stuff going around that's pretty common, does that introduce a bias that could potentially make them miss things and, you know, not be paying attention? And to be honest, we don't know, and there's a small portion of the audience that I've sort of presented this to that sort of get that, oh, wait, it might actually have this opposite effect. And I think it needs to be studied. It needs to be assessed. Some of the results I didn't show show here is that if you give this information to doctors and you ask them, well, does it change how often you would order a CBC or a blood culture or think about admitting a patient to the hospital, those numbers drop way, way down, so that the majority actually say, no, I'm still gonna think about ordering those tests that would tell me about a more severe infection, because, you know, they're gonna trust their clinical judgment about this one looks a little bit more ill. And I would argue that if you give them information and sort of say, this is how these things present, this is what you should expect, that they'll do a better job of finding the ones that are presenting a little bit different, look a little more ill, and it's potentially even an education opportunity to improve their ability to find the abnormal stuff. Does that help?
Do you want me to thank you again?
Thank you very much.